Hey, everybody, it's March 9th, 2022. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio, and thanks so much for being with us today. I've got a nice show for you today. We've got Professor Mark R. Warren, who's a professor of public policy and public affairs at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, the Boston campus, and he's author of a new book called Willful Defiance, The Movement to Dismantle the School-to-Prison Pipeline. And he's a public policy guy and a sociologist. It's going to be really interesting. And I'm going to bring him on in just a second. We've also got, she just called in, I was hoping she would, we've got Zakiya Sankara Jabbar. And Zakiya is co-founder and executive director of a group called Racial Justice Now. And that's dedicated to grassroots organizing to dismantle this school-to-prison pipeline, a phrase I absolutely despise because of what it stands for. And they've got chapters in Dayton, Ohio, and Metro D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And she did put on her website, I will make this joke right now, she put, the website is RJN, that's Racial Justice Now, DMV, the three most frightening initials to any citizen of any state, that stands for Department of Motor Vehicles. And then I realized that what she was talking about, I'm pretty sure she's laughing now, is D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. But DMV is always frightening. And Mark lives in Massachusetts. He knows what I'm talking about. We're going to archive this show over at ace-ed.org. All right, which is our equity and access website, our magazine, our online journal for educators, or anybody, by the way, is Equity and Access. Go online, click on the cover, you'll see a wonderful magazine, million articles, not quite a million, but close, on the website. All our podcasts are over there, my column podcast, Afterthoughts, and a link to our SEL Today website at seltoday.org. All right, I'm Larry Jacobs. This is going to be a fun show, and I've got to start with Zakiya. Zakiya, welcome to the show with DMV, not the Department of Motor Vehicles, right?
Good morning, good morning. Yes, it's Zakiya, actually, and I'm doing well this morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure to have you here. You're in Ohio, aren't you?
I'm in Maryland, actually.
Oh, Maryland. Good enough. Okay, very good. And welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here. We're going to give you a lot of time to talk about racial justice now. Professor Warren, Mark, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning. Thanks
good morning. Call me Larry, both of you, please. It's a pleasure to have you here. Okay? And Mark, tell us what you do and tell us about your new book, Willful Defiance. That's the start of this conversation.
Sure. So I, as you said, I'm a professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, and I've been studying and working with parents and youth or in community organizing groups working for racial equity and educational justice for over 25 years now.
Good man.
And I consider myself a community engaged scholar, which or an activist scholar, which means that when I do my research, I do it in deep partnership with people on the ground who are doing the organizing and the hard work to, you know, transform our school towards educational justice. And so Zakiya is one of, and Racial Justice Now is one of my partners in producing this book, Willful Defiance. So I'm really happy that she's able to be here and share her wisdom and her lessons herself. But the book is about the movement to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline, and I called it Willful Defiance because people may or may not know that each year schools suspend hundreds of thousands of students for something called willful defiance.
It's sometimes called disrupting school. I did not know that. Yeah, well.
It's sometimes called disrupting school or willful disruption. But it's a kind of vague and subjective category, that catch-all kind of category that encompasses, you know, if a student won't take his hat off or has had it backwards, or if a student were to question or challenge the teacher, you know, our textbooks our history textbooks are coming from Texas. Why is that? Is that really the history we should be learning? These are all, you know, disrupting education, willful defiance. And so we try to flip the script, because what we're saying is that, in fact, young people and their families should willfully defy a system if it's really set up to punish and control them and not to educate them. And, you know, unfortunately, when people challenge these kinds of suspensions or expulsions and policing practices in schools,
yep.
that they are oftentimes punished, and parents are sometimes excluded, even sometimes arrested themselves for disrupting school. Sure. They're actually, it's a criminal offense in some states to willfully defy school authority, if you can believe that. And so the book is really about the movement of people to challenge these kinds of racist and exclusionary discipline policies and policing practices. And in fact, you know, and that's the kind of movement that groups like Racial Justice Now have been a part of. And the book tries to document not just, you know, how this school-to-prison pipeline operates, how, you know, young people, particularly black and brown students, are pushed out of school through these suspension policies and then into the criminal justice system, or the police and the policing practices where sometimes students are, you know, arrested right in school and sent into the juvenile or criminal justice system right from school. So that's what the book is really about.
Thank you for writing it, and that's great. Zakiya, you started Racial Justice Now, and I know you're a mom, and would you like to talk about your experiences as a black parent? Okay, I'm a white guy. Dr. Warren is a white guy as well. We may see things differently, and I appreciate everything you're going to say here. Tell us how you got involved with this. Okay, I'm really interested.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I want to hear it through your eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I got involved really early on in my son's, I guess, the beginning of his matriculation through school. And he was in preschool when we started to have issues. He was starting to be identified as a problem. And at first, I didn't see it as a racial justice issue at the beginning until – you know, a couple of months in, and I started to notice, you know, that it became a pattern, the type of calls I would get, you know, from the school, you know, some of the things that they would say. And then I just, you know, intuitively, I started talking to other black parents there, and particularly what I noticed was the moms who also had sons had similar experiences that I did. I was in college at the time, so I went to my university's library, and I went into JSTOR. Folks who went to college know what JSTOR is. And I just put in the search, just real general. I put black boys and education. And to say the least, all kinds of things came up. I mean, I was trying to understand what was happening to me, right? I did not grow up, obviously, as an activist or anything like that. I mean, obviously, I'm a black woman in America. I know race is an issue, but I didn't know that I didn't know what I know now, right? When I began to read some of the scholarship of folks like, you know, Dr. Juwanza Kanjufu, who wrote a book back in the 80s, mind you. This was the early 80s, and here I am. I was born in the early 80s, so he has been studying this since my entire life.
Yep.
And the book was called Countering the Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, and I tell everyone that story because that book politicized me. I had no idea that the education system did the type of things that it did to black students in general and black boys in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that literally, you know, it launched the beginning of what would become this organization that's still doing work now, almost 11 years later, to fight for educational justice and equal, you know, opportunity for black children in our public schools. So we did a lot of work in Dayton, a lot of work around the entire state of Ohio, eventually got a couple of state laws done. We were very instrumental, our little small group of black parents, you know, just a group of scrappy moms who were fighting back and said, you know, we want to repeal Ohio's zero-tolerance law. It's absolutely ridiculous that we have a zero-tolerance law in Ohio because that's what the school districts were falling back on and saying, well, you know, we're following the law. The law says we have to have zero tolerance for disruptive behavior. So that's another catch-all like willful defiance. I believe willful defiance was a California code. In Ohio, it's called disruptive behavior. And so after a couple of years, we were able to successfully repeal huge chunks of that Ohio zero tolerance law. And then a couple of years after that, we were able to get a law passed in Ohio that went into full effect just last year in 2021 that says you cannot suspend or expel really young children, pre-K through third grade in Ohio schools. You can't kick them out of school.
Wait, Zakiya, expel young kids?
Ohio is one of the states that is expelling three-year-olds. Absolutely, yes.
From public schools.
It's really sad.
They were expelling pre-K and K through 2 kids from public schools. Am I hearing correctly? I did not know this.
Yes, that's a common practice, unfortunately. And I'll even let your viewers know about another scholar, Dr. William Gilliam out of the Yale Child Study Center. He's one of the few scholars that's actually looked at. That's actually looked at preschool suspension specifically, because you don't have the same amount of data for preschool across the nation, because preschool is not required by law. And so he looked at a lot of the private institutions, which is where my son was, a private preschool. And he looked at, you know, parochial private schools, you know, and other types of institutions. And his research is valid. He saw black boys outpaced literally any other subgroup of students. They completely outpaced any other subgroup of students in preschool expulsions specifically.
It's unbelievable.
And so it shows you that we have a tragedy in this country as we talk about equitable education. We had Brown back in 1954, but unfortunately, schools have done all kinds of things to not live up to that law to give African Americans
over the years
absolutely an equitable access to a good public education. So groups like mine and other groups that Mark is working with across the country, led by parents and youth and some of our allied advocacy organizations, legal advocacy organizations, have supported this movement where that parents and students of color and black parents and students are leading across the nation to continue this fight for an equitable education, even in 2022.
It's hard to believe, and I love the way you just ended that, even in 2022, which is exactly what I was thinking, okay? Hopefully we've come a long way. Mark, so let me ask the professor, Mark Warren, okay? Again, his book is Willful Defiance. Why did this happen, Mark? I mean, it's 2022. This is nuts. And we understand, okay, that there are – you know, when you're raised, if I may, just a stereotype in a lower income situation, it's harder. There's not books in the house. There's not this. It's harder to go to school. And we should know by now. You know, you'll take all those things into consideration. And from what I understand, a lot of school districts and teachers are doing that. But it seems to me the problem is still pretty widespread. Why did this happen? Why did we let it happen? Dr. Warren, you're on.
All right. Well, first, I just want to add to Zakiya's point about preschool suspensions and expulsions, because, as you say, most people aren't aware of this.
I'm not aware of it.
50,000 students are suspended from preschool every year, and about 17,000 are expelled. This is preschool. And
this is public preschool public and private? That's unbelievable. I can't believe it.
And, as he was talking about, you know, black students are disproportionately only about 20% of the preschool population, but almost 50% of those who are suspended. So almost half of all the preschool students who are suspended are black. So I just want to put that in, because, you know, what Zakiya is talking about and her direct experience and her research, you know, has been also borne out by, as she was saying, many others, and there are now at least some numbers on this, although As she says, it's the numbers are harder to get because it's not required, but we are getting them. In any case, I think that, first of all, it's important to understand that this school-to-prison pipeline arose really in the 1990s. So we're going back over 30 years now to the origins of it. And I think it has to be understood as part of the broader movement towards what Michelle Alexander called the new Jim Crow, a kind of system of racial domination and control that came in a way, as a pushback against the gains of the civil rights movement. And so that involved, as many people now know, the mass incarceration of large numbers of particularly African-American and Latinx people, often men. And so that we had, 6 million people incarcerated by the early 2000s. So, and this was zero tolerance and three strikes and you're out. All these things that were happening in the community then got transferred into school. And so we started to have zero tolerance discipline policies in school, and we started to move police and armed security guards in large numbers into our schools. In the 1970s, there were only 100 police officers in U.S. public school total, 100 total across the entire country. By the early 2000s, there were 16,000 police officers or armed security guards in our schools, and that number has only gone up since then. And so it was, I think we have to really understand it as part of this larger system. And in some ways, what many people say is, a kind of pushback against the success of, or at least the success during its time of school desegregation efforts. So schools are now, black students are no longer segregated. They're to some extent desegregated, at least legally. Yeah. And in response, the schools developed this system of punishment and control in those schools. And, that's where we're at today. Now, the movement has made some gains. So I think that's important to understand. So even on this willful defiance issue, Zakiya has talked about some of their gains in Ohio, but in Los Angeles, for example, a group of organizing groups passed the School Climate Bill of Rights in 2012, I think it was, that banned suspensions for willful defiance. And then it was brought up to the state level. And so the number of lost days of instruction due to that suspension fell from 75,000 in 2008 down to 5,600 in a few years ago. So we have had some gains, but we also have had some new gains now in trying to remove or defund police from schools. Because, the reality is police have no place in our public schools. They do not. There's no evidence at all that police make schools safer. There's none. And instead, what we learn is that the presence of police directs the attention of the school away from educational objectives and towards disciplining and punishing. Students are more likely to be arrested or involved with the police and criminal justice system in schools where there are police. And again, this is disproportionate. Particularly African-American and also Latinx students are disproportionately involved with the police and subject to arrest, usually, almost always, for non-criminal behavior. So we have over 200,000 school-based referrals for law enforcement every year, and over 60,000 students are arrested in schools every year, and normally they're for minor behavioral issues.
Like what? Mouthing off to the principal or something?
Yeah. Because now the policing has become so deeply embedded, particularly in schools serving low-income students of color, that the police are called in for disciplinary matters. So one of the most famous cases happened in Spring Valley, South Carolina, a few years back. A girl, an African-American girl named Shakara, was in
the classroom. I remember this. I knew where you were going. That policeman who came into her room and dragged her out of the room?
Dragged her out of her chair, dragged her across the floor. It went viral. It was filmed by another African-American girl, Maya Kenny.
Yep.
And her infraction, the teacher asked her to give him her cell phone. She said she didn't have her cell phone on her, and he said, "I've had enough of you. I'm calling the assistant principal." The assistant principal said to her, please hand in your cell phone. She said, I don't have my cell phone with me. He said, I've had enough of you. And he called in the school resource officer, who then assaulted her. And she and Naya Kenny, who filmed the incident, were both charged with criminal disrupting school, a criminal charge of disrupting
the
school.
The kid who filmed it as well.
She refused to hand in her cell phone, whether if he even had one. And the crime of the other girl was filming a police assault on a black girl. That was their crime. And, of course, the officer was never charged or convicted of anything.
Oh,
now,
I remember that different. That's interesting. I remember that differently. I thought he was charged.
Yes, to this day, that officer does not take responsibility. There's actually a documentary on the Starz Network that actually, you know, it tells the entire story. And Shakara, the young lady who was assaulted, it's her first time actually speaking publicly. I happened to run across it on Starz over the weekend, and I sat down and watched it with my family. And my son, the same son, right, that I was talking about who, you know, was being identified as a problem when he was 3 years old, he's now in high school here in the Montgomery County area of Washington, D.C. in Maryland. And MCPS, we worked with community groups last year with students and other allies to get the police removed out of the building for the first time in 19 years here in Montgomery County Public Schools. Unfortunately, we are seeing that lots of wins like that are being rolled back within months. And so that's the case here in MCPS, where the school board just voted on February 24th to return police back into the schools because of a few high-profile incidents that has happened in schools. But here's the thing. You know, there's literally not one iota of evidence that police in schools actually keep children safe. Unfortunately, there was an SRO there at the school shooting that happened in Florida. And the SRO was there and was not able to prevent that shooting. We know that to prevent the type of things like that happening in our schools, you have to start with deep relationships. You have to have a climate in the school that is positive. You have to have a positive school culture and climate. We have to begin to change the relationships between teachers and staff and students.
Absolutely.
A lot of our schooling is focused on control. And so the philosophy of schools have to change, and we have to have a restorative and transformative approach to young people in our schools. So because now we're in a pandemic and the young people have returned to schools this year, there's also a crisis of mental health. We worked to get the police out of schools here in Montgomery County, everyone said, listen, take that money and reinvest it in culturally competent social workers and counselors. Let's look at having community intervention workers. Let's make sure we have restorative justice coordinators in every building. Those are the things that we ask for. Unfortunately, when school started this year, we didn't have those things.
That's right.
None of those things were in place. And so now, after all of the high-profile incidents where, unfortunately, there was a shooting in a school back in January here in Montgomery County, and then there was a physical assault and stabbing last year in November in 2021 in another high school. These young people are in crisis, so there's a lot of fights. My son tells me about it. He's tall, and now he's taller than me. He's a big boy. He's in ninth grade. And he comes home, and he says, Mom, you know, there's a lot of fights at school. And I said, I know, son. You know, these children need support. They need wraparound support, not more police, because unfortunately, the police are armed, and we don't need armed police who look at African American children as adults, who look at them as a problem, who look at them as a potential criminal, a predator. This is the fear of that not just me as a mother. Plenty of our community members here, other African-American mothers and community members alike, are simply afraid that, you know, the police being in the schools because they're armed, they shoot first and ask questions later. No one wants their child to be assaulted the way that we saw that happen in South Carolina, and we certainly don't want officers to have access to their guns, as we saw with Kim Porter up in Minneapolis, who only received 2 years in jail. for shooting and killing that young man because, oh, I thought I was pulling out my taser. Can you imagine a child being shot in one of our schools and the police say, oh, I didn't mean to pull the real gun. I thought it was my taser. It's unacceptable. And so we're still putting pressure right now, today, on the Montgomery County School Board, and we're putting pressure on our county council who appropriates the budget and the county executive who appropriates the budget to the schools to say, hey, the school board sent this over here. We're asking you all to reject the fact that they're asking you all for more money for police and security guards in elementary school. So we have a lot of work to do. Our hands are full here. Montgomery County Public Schools is the largest school district in Maryland with over 160,000 students and the 14th largest in the entire nation. So we definitely have our work cut out for us here.
You do, and they're lucky, your group is lucky to have you on their side. Okay, you're really something, I got to tell you, Zakiya. You really are good at this. Okay, and you're doing a good job. But my question is, and you were right, without question, I don't think anyone would argue this, about the need for more counselors, and if I may, more teachers of color within the schools. We've got to have that, okay, which always is something that makes me sad that we don't. Okay, but we don't have those things, and there's a – I hate to say this, and you guys can talk about this, Mark. There's a dollar problem and a training problem. We don't have the people, and do we have the money to train them properly? Okay, and how long will that take? And you know, when we talk about police in schools, you said that it doesn't necessarily protect students. And I'm wondering if some of it is it protects teachers. And I'm not defending that. I'm just saying maybe that's the mindset. Mark, what's going on out there? How do we crack this? Okay, what are we going to do? We have to start it. We have to start it. K-12, I talked over you. I'm sorry, Zakiya. Say it again.
No, I just wanted to really quickly, and I'll bring Mark in, I just wanted to thank you for bringing up the point around teachers of color. That is something that our organization advocates for. We particularly advocate more for black men in our schools. And here's
why.
Because black male students, no matter what school district you go to, you find them the highest in the negative outcomes in education, K-12. They have the highest numbers. And then they have the lowest numbers, right, lowest access to gifted and talented and other sort of positive graduation rates.
Absolutely. You're dead on right.
Sort of the more positive, right, the positive outcomes in education.
You're dead on right.
But then you look at the teaching force, and Mark can tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe the teaching force is about 70% white women across the country in K-12. And so that's something that we absolutely advocate for is not just increasing teachers of color, but we want to actually increase more African-American men teachers.
Absolutely.
Particularly. And here in Montgomery County, there is a group of African-American male teachers in the school system here that have organized around that issue. They're called the Bond Educators, B-O-N-D, and they organize around that specific issue. And my organization is going to use our organizing and advocacy skills to put pressure on the school board to actually make sure that they are going to the right schools to recruit teachers of color. We are surrounded by HBCUs in Maryland. We got Howard in
That's
D.C.
Right.
You got Morgan
and
State up in Baltimore.
I'll tell you where else to go.
Yeah.
And that's the community colleges. That's where young people go. Okay, and especially because it's less expensive and the teaching is good,
right?
And they can can see where they will succeed, and that's where we have to push. I just have to say this before I get back to you, Mark. They have to push black folks, the Latino folks, if I may, into education, and they can do that if they say to you, "Look, teach for 10 years, we'll pay your college tuition. Come up with something that works." Okay, we got all this money for all this other crap. We might as well use it for something good. Okay, that's my thought. I couldn't agree with you more, Zakiya. It's unbelievable. Mark, go ahead, you talk. What are we going to do about all this, Mark?
Sure.
Professor,
so,
come on,
know,
profess
I,
something, Professor. Go ahead.
Well,
make it
I,
so.
I actually think part of the solution has got to come from the community-based solutions to these problems, right? So we have to find ways.
Well,
that's why when I go out and speak about the book, Willful Defiance, you know, the movement to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline, this book, it has voices of people like Zakiya. In fact, the book opens with her story and her voice. But we have to find
places where community and parents and young people are at the table creating the solutions that we need. We have a broken system now where, you know, so-called experts, who are often professors or scholars, you know, do research, remove from communities, and then they advise educational leaders and administrators who then adopt policies that are then imposed down on families and schools and teachers too often who don't have any buy-in to what's going on. And these kinds of solutions just aren't working. You know, we need to be looking at things like restorative and transformative justice.
We do.
As alternatives that really are trying to create, you know, safe and supportive school communities, not by punishing young people, but by building, you know, really empowering relationships with them and with their families and their parents, so that we can have, you know, schools that are more connected to communities, that are teaching culturally relevant curriculum, that that resolve issues not by discipline and control, but by, you know, holding restorative circles that seek to identify the deeper root causes of the issues and restore harm. You know, and these are the kinds of solutions that have emerged out of community organizing efforts.
Yep.
So I think part of the answer to this, yes, we need more funding, because part of the problem is that, you know, we are underfunding our schools and our low-income communities of color, right? We have plenty of money to spend on education in our more affluent suburbs, but we don't have that money.
Go figure that out. Yeah, that's the essence of equity, I might add. What you just said is the essence of equity. Yeah.
Right.
Put the money where it's needed.
What I'm hoping is that this discussion of willful defiance and the school-to-prison pipeline, it's not only about school discipline. It's not only about policing. That's an opening into the discussion of what we really need to be doing to transform our schools to be places of education and liberation for young people. And I think increasing the number of teachers of color, particularly black male teachers, but
Absolutely.
Other teachers of color is important. But also transforming the way that we educate any teacher who comes through the system, because, you know, most of, you know, unfortunately, you know, being a white female doesn't determine everything, but what it suggests is that you've grown up in a fairly segregated white environment without a lot of experience or relationships in communities of color, and then you've gone through a U.S. educational system that has not taught you these things, right? It's really based on a kind of Eurocentric and white perspective.
Yeah.
And so now when you end up in a school in Baltimore or wherever, you're not, whatever, you know, color you are, you're not necessarily prepared to reach out and form partnerships with families and students. And so then you have teachers who feel under assault by the system, who don't know, aren't really prepared for what they're doing, then they fall back on discipline and control and policing. And that's the system that I think has to get broken.
And Mark, I have to ask this. We've known this for a while. I know the 90s were crazy with the mass incarceration and all that sort of stuff. But that's 20 years ago. And the things you're saying, okay, I agree with. I mean, and mostly everybody would agree with it. Are we making progress? You know, anybody who, like, take Boston, okay, a supposedly liberal city in liberal Massachusetts, best education in the country. How we did, where you are, how we doing in Boston? Just put that one into perspective. Yeah.
No, I mean, and Boston is supposed to have one of the best big city educational systems in the country. But if you are a black student in third grade and you don't go to one of the only three exam high schools that there are, so all the black students in the entire city, your chances of even graduating from high school are only 50%. 50%. And then of the 50% who graduate high school, of that 50%, only 25% will enroll in college. And of that 25%, only 12% will actually graduate with a college degree within 5 or 6 years. So we are in a situation now where our economy is so knowledge-based that only 12% of black students entering third grade in Boston are going to end up with a college degree, you know, at an age of 24, 25. So we are failing our students even in a place like Boston. This is a really deep-seated system. And unfortunately, we might want to say it's old news, but it really isn't. And in fact, zero tolerance. In 2008, when the Dignity in Schools campaign formed, which, you know, is a national coalition that Racial Justice Now is part of,
and one of my partners in the book, Wolf of Defiance, when they first started challenging, when they formed in 2008 and challenged Zero Tolerance, it was the law of the land. We're talking about 14 years ago. It was enshrined in state policy and district policy. It was federal government policy. Every national teachers union had a policy of zero tolerance school discipline. All of the national education associations of various sorts all adopted zero tolerance. And it took within six years of organizing, almost all of those associations and national teachers unions changed their policy, including the federal government.
Yeah.
However,
because it didn't work.
Local unions is a different story.
Yeah.
And now policing is that frontier, right? When people start saying, well, we have to defund or remove police from schools, well, now that's the challenging issue that people don't want to necessarily take on. You know, we still have, in Boston as well, we have police, we have not defunded or removed armed security officers and police officers from our schools. And it's not even just removing them. We don't want them called in either, right? You could remove police from schools, but then they can be called back in for, again, minor behavioral matters. So it's just I think for many of us maybe who might be white or who might be more affluent,
yeah.
We don't really necessarily understand that there is really two different educational systems in operation in this country. And a lot of when I speak to whiter, more affluent audiences, people often don't have any idea what is really going on in the schools in our urban or our low income communities of color, across the country. And I think part of the purpose of Willful Defiance book is to bring this to light, but also not just to bring it to light as the systemic racism problem that we have, but to show that there are people organizing against it. People are not just victims.
Good point.
Kia and so many of these organizers, African-American parents, they are on some level, obviously, have been victimized them, but they have, gone on a journey to become racial justice organizers with their fellow parents or students also are in the book, too, as people who have been organizing to change this system. And so we have cause hope. Things are changing, but it's slow. And, I'm hoping that this book will push us forward.
I hope so, too. Again, the book is Willful Defiance. Everybody can go on Amazon. Okay, Willful Defiance by our guest, Mark R. Warren, Professor Warren. Zakiya, how do you feel about all this? And we got about 3 minutes left, but do you feel really good that you're making progress, or is it just, do you think it's just we're in for the really long haul? Just your attitude about all this.
Well, absolutely. Thank you. I try to stay optimistic and, to Mark's point around like affluent districts, my family moved here to Montgomery County because of the reputation of the schools and the schools in Dayton.
There you go.
The excuse was always, this was the excuse. It was always, Dayton Public Schools is underfunded because the way we fund public schools in Ohio has been ruled by the Ohio Supreme Court as unconstitutional. They pay for schools through property taxes. And because Dayton is a deindustrialized city where all of the auto plants that provided those middle-class jobs packed up and went to Mexico. And those middle-class jobs for people who didn't have a college degree, they're gone. And so now – The biggest
Agreed.
Employer for a middle class job, you have to be in the medical industry, in Dayton, either a nurse or something like that. And then Walmart and other jobs are now, the biggest for people who don't have, a college education. And so what we see, there, and I saw the writing on the wall, was that things were going to get exponentially worse in that particular school district. And unfortunately, it has. A lot of things have, especially now with the pandemic, have, really gotten worse. And so one of the attractive things about Montgomery County Schools is that it had a reputation of being one of the best school systems, public school systems, in the country. It's a very wealthy, extremely wealthy suburb of D.C. But then we get here and we realize, there's still issues around racial justice here. Black students are still the most suspended in Montgomery County Public Schools. And then the other thing here is that, you know, the school district has been sued, I don't know how many times, for the way that they provide access to gifted and talented programs. Black students have been systemically kept out of those types of programs.
I do a lot of shows on that. You're absolutely right. I work with a group called the National Association of Gifted Children. It's brutal. Yeah, it's brutal. It's unfair.
Right, and so it goes to show you that the common denominator around the country is anti-blackness. I mean, well, you got to call it what it is. And so now that fight,
for me.
Absolutely, you know, so we have to, like I said, our hands are full. I'm encouraged by the amount of parents that are coming to join our organization. We have some Ethiopian parents. Their kids are catching hell in schools, and they didn't know what they could do about it. Because D.C., as you know, is a very diverse community ethnically, and it was sort of a culture shock for me when I moved here, because I went to my son's school for the first time, and another black woman walked up to me, and she started speaking Amharic. She just assumed I was Ethiopian. I looked Ethiopian to her.
We got about a minute left, so you can just finish up. Yeah.
So we appreciate, you know, all the allies that we have here. There's certainly a lot of allies who are now waking up to the fact, because there just hadn't been anybody as an organization unapologetically calling out the mistreatment of black children in the school district here. And so we, like I said, we have our hands full. We attend all the school board meetings, and we also do advocacy at the county council level with the county executives as well.
Yeah, these days attending school board meetings, it used to be a quiet time. Now it's pretty loud and raucous. So keep your make sure you have plenty of the coffee when you go in there. Both of you, we got to leave. And you guys made great points. I really appreciate this. I'll tell everybody how to get in touch when we're done. So Zakiya, thank you. Keep up the good work. It's lovely to have you here. And Mark, thank you, my friend. It's great we got together on this. Thank you both.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay.
You're welcome. You guys take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
Thank you. Okay, everybody. I wanted to make sure we did this. Racial Justice Now. You can go to RJNDMV.org. Okay? And for Mark, he's at the University of Mark Ward, University of Massachusetts, Boston, but his book is called Willful Defiance. It's really interesting stuff. The movement to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline is just astounding when you really hear about it, okay? And that's, you can get it at Amazon, Willful Defiance. And I hope Vladimir Putin doesn't hear about these catch-all phrases to start putting people down. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. All right, we're going to archive the show over at ace-ed.org. I'm Larry Jacobs. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it.